Walt Disney once said that for every laugh, there should be a tear, which is why I think, anyway, he would have loved Drawn to Life, that hugely entertaining, surprising, and emotional spectacle, which is now being presented live on stage at Disney Springs in Lake Buena Vista, Florida. Presented by Cirque du Soleil and Disney, this is a show that I can guarantee you will captivate audiences of all ages. Drawn to Life is a must-see, family-friendly spectacle that will leave you, well, in awe. So don't miss out on your chance to be part of the magic. Plan your visit to Disney Springs today and reserve your seats for Drawn to Life by Cirque du Soleil and Disney live on stage. Set your imagination in motion.
Welcome back to another edition of the Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. It's me, Len Testa, and this is our show for the week of Shimmer's Day, April 1st, 2024. On the show today, news, lots and lots of news. Then in our main segment, Jim tells us how Disney World's Treasure Island became Discovery Island. Let's get started by bringing in the man who's an honorary citizen of Rhythm Nation. It's Mr. Jim Hill. Jim, how's it going?
Well, sad to report, Len, that I've actually had my citizenship revoked. Turns out I'm a white male in my 60s, so I lack the ability, at the genetic level, mind you, to clap on the beat, which is a punishable offense in Rhythm Nation. So
you were asked to leave. That's fine. It happens to all of us.
But while I appealed this decision, I am banished to the Polka Palace. So I'm spending my days tuning accordions. And since nobody knows what a tuned accordion sounds like, this is kind of an episode in futility. So
I don't believe the words tuned and accordion have ever come in the same English sentence before. Congratulations on breaking that ground.
Well, there we go.
And I want to know, is Polka Palace, is the leader there Lawrence Welk? Like the descendant of Lawrence Welk, is that?
There's a lovely chapel.
All right. Before we get started, Jim, let's do a quick shout-out. Thanks to everyone who subscribes to the show over at patreon.com/JimHillMedia, including Nathaniel West Rosenthal, Michael Galasso, Sean Moore, Bob Boyd, Dana Snyder, and Jana Whalen. Jim, these are the Disney caterers helping Tiana set up her party inside the new Tiana's Bayou Adventure attraction in Frontierland. They say they enjoy the parts of the job that are absolutely essential, but not glamorous, like scheduling deliveries and buying decorations, and reminding the alligators that their arms are simply not long enough to put tablecloths on the tables, but they are true geniuses when it comes to party music. True story.
Wow.
It's about identifying talent, Jim. That's what management does. Identifies talent.
There we go.
All right, on to the news. And there's a lot of news today. The news is sponsored by Touring Plans. Touring Plans helps you save time and money at theme parks like Walt Disney World. Check us out at touringplans.com. All right, Jim, the big news. Every show should begin with a round of self-congratulations. Back at our November live show at MIT, we said that there were behind-the-scenes discussions going on between Disney and the Florida legislature around ending their flight over the Reedy Creek Improvement District. Last week, Disney and the Central Florida Tourism Oversight Board announced a truce of sorts in their ongoing legal war. You saw this, right?
I did. Just yesterday. In fact, Nancy, I was in the car driving and Nancy read me the tweet.
All right. So the media are reporting this as a settlement. I don't think it's a settlement. I really think it is a truce. And that's why I chose that word. And the reason why I think it's a truce is that both sides still have some weapons. So let's go over the basics. Disney agrees to drop the developer agreement and the restrictive covenants that Reedy Creek approved before the takeover, and also changes that were made in January of 2023 around the comprehensive long-term plan. Disney also agrees to drop the changes to the comprehensive plans and land development agreements that the old Reedy Creek put in place in February of 2023. So, Jim, if I understand correctly, we're back to having the 2020 comprehensive plan as the thing that we all agree on.
Well, I mean, it's got to be a baseline at some point, I guess.
Okay, so the district agreed to review and possibly amend that 2020 plan, including consulting Disney and other parties. Both Disney and the state agreed to dismiss and not refile their state lawsuits, including those seeking public records requests. Disney gets ownership of long-term environmental impact mitigation credits, and the district agrees not to interfere with Disney using them. Disney's federal court case currently on appeal gets to be deferred while both sides negotiate a new long-term developer deal, and both sides agree not to sue over actions taken before a specific date. I don't have that date, with a couple of exceptions around settlements and defenses for the federal lawsuit. So those are the basics. I mean, to me, this looks like a classic sort of compromise. Everyone gets a little bit of what they want in the short term, nobody gets everything they want in the long term, and both sides have to commit to working together for that long term to happen.
As Florida's largest employer, and more to the point that this whole issue had been a cudgel that was being used to beat Ron DeSantis, to the effect of, you know, this is not helping. You know, this was one of the things when he abandoned his presidential campaign, this was one of the things that people pointed to, that this was, you know, a self-inflicted wound, so to speak.
100%. Yeah. Yeah. I think there are two things that had to do this. One, it's an election year, and, you know, the governor isn't up for election, but a lot of the state legislature is. So in talking to some people over the last, you know, 48 hours as this has happened, here's what I've learned. So Donald Trump, the Republican nominee for president, is on record saying Florida's fight with Disney was a political stunt that failed, and said that DeSantis got beat by Disney over it. So you would expect this topic to come up as in Florida's presidential race. And the Central Florida Tourism Oversight Board does not want to be misaligned with their presidential nominee on stances around this issue. All right. So I think the immediate thing is the Republican nominee doesn't think this is a big deal. Why does the Central Florida Tourism Oversight Board think it's a big deal? But the other interesting thing, and I talked to some pollsters about this, Republican voters in Florida, so the base, say that the economy and housing costs are their top two issues for this campaign, and it's not even close. So like 35% of Republican voters right now say the economy and jobs is their number one issue. The number two issue is housing costs and housing insurance, which has gone up a lot in the last couple of years. 13% say it's immigration. No other topic gets more than 8% of the view. And nothing like, you know, woke ideology in schools made the top 10 concerns of Republican voters. Okay, so it's not a concern to voters. Their presidential nominee is on a different side. So this is sort of that alignment. I'll also point out this. D23 is in August, which is, if I understand the Gregorian calendar correctly, Jim, 3 months before that election, and everyone expects Disney to announce major theme park projects at D23. But Disney can play hardball, and they could say at D23, here are the projects we want to build in Florida, but the political situation there makes it too risky to invest. And then every politician in Florida is going to spend the next 3 months explaining that if you stare really hard at the cartoons, a couple of background characters look kind of gay, so Florida shouldn't accept Disney's $17 billion jobs. Right? That's a difficult conversation, Jim. A difficult conversation. The other thing I'm going to note is that the composition of the board has changed enough that Disney's probably satisfied that the board knows how to work on big municipal projects that require consensus and compromise. So Stephanie Kopoulousis is the new Central Florida Tourism Oversight Board Administrator. She was Ron DeSantis' Director of Legislative Affairs, previously Florida Department of Transportation Secretary, and has a background in public policy and transportation. So that makes sense. Greg Mateer also joined the board yesterday. His background is in hospitality and logistics. I can totally see that. And I'm going to go on the record here, Jim. Jim's just going to put this little token down. It would not shock me to learn years from now that we did not hear the whole story about how this board changed. And I'm going to leave it at that.
Okay. You know, I have, that's the thing. I have a lot of stories like that where literally I have been told I can't even tell the story till after the kids die.
Like, yeah, this is one of those things where it's like the people are going to read this at my funeral. So that's what's going to happen. So here's the other thing. Like, so definitely the calendar has a lot to do with. So we've been saying for over a year that Imagineering had to hire people to create the ideas that the board could then approve to spend $17 billion over 10 years, right? And we said that Imagineering didn't have the people, right? But that was last year. And that hiring, I'm told, should largely be done by summer of this year. So if you're a project manager at Disney, and you're looking a few steps ahead, getting construction permits, environmental impact studies done, stuff like that, is going to be on the critical path soon. And the Central Florida Tourism Oversight Board could have slow walked all of that to death. The other thing is, next month, Disney faces a shareholder vote about future leadership, and they don't want this Reedy Creek thing to come up as part of the vote because institutional investors care about revenue. They don't care about the Constitution. So even if Disney thinks it's right and can win the federal case, the state can drag this on longer than shareholders would be willing to support management fighting it. And so there's an incentive on both sides to get this done in the next few months.
Oh, no, absolutely. In fact, that was the thing I said in the car yesterday when Nancy was reading me this info. It's like that, you know, that the timing of this is deliberate. Then that Iger doesn't want Nelson Peltz to be able to bring this up at, you know, the virtual shareholders meeting.
Yeah. So there were incentives on both sides based on the calendar to get things done. This is entirely expected. And it came a couple of months after the end of Governor DeSantis' presidential campaign, which is sort of the timeline that we said back in November. So that makes sense. Good for us.
There we go. So
all right. And more importantly, it's good to hear that we can get this investment in Florida back on track. That's always good. And speaking of investment in Florida, Universal Orlando has released details on a new land for its upcoming Epic Universe, and this one is for How to Train Your Dragon. Jim, I've got the concept art in the show notes there. The big rider, the first one announced, was this thing called Hiccup's Wing Gliders. And I'll read you the description. It's Hiccup invites brave new Vikings to take a ride in his latest glider contraption, a winged flying machine that launches aspiring dragon riders into the sky for a dragon's eye view of Berk. Guests will fly along Hiccup and Toothless and reach speeds of up to 45 miles an hour as they soar around the perimeter of Berk and even through the lagoon, while experiencing firsthand what it's like to fly on a dragon. So, looks like a sort of family-friendly-ish coaster?
Yeah. Okay.
All right, fair. Looks good. And a couple of pieces of concept right there. The next one is a stage show called The Untrainable Dragon, with characters Hiccup, Toothless, Gobber, and Astrid, as they work together to solve the mystery of the untrainable dragon. So, musical numbers, breathtaking sets, and life-size dragons soaring overhead. I want to know, Jim, how they came up with the scale for a life-size dragon.
Well,
how big is a life-size dragon? Do we know?
It is interesting you bring this up, because I want to say 10 years ago now, the folks who did the Walking with Dinosaurs arena show, they actually paired with DreamWorks and for a time had a show traveling the country that used that same sort of on-stage hiding in plain sight mechanisms of animatronic dragons. And in fact, one of those moments where I was going out to California for a press event and they were in Worcester, Massachusetts. So Nancy went in my place to the press day for the How to Train Your Dragon arena show and just came back blithering about, oh my God, I get to pet a dragon. They were very convincing full size. And I would bet you this is pretty much this very same technology, which, by the way, there is a show very much like this being presented in Beijing. So at the Universal Park there. So artful bit of recycling.
It's funny that you mention stuff coming in from outside the United States, because the next attraction, the Fire Drill, F-Y-R-E Drill, is a shooting gallery boat ride.
No.
And so here's the description of it. The concept art is excellent for this one, by the way. Mischievous Viking twins Roughnut and Toughnut invite teams of Vikings to compete to outscore and outsoak each other on this wet and wild boat battle. Guests will board a colorful dragon-headed boat. By the way, all boats should be dragon-headed. I don't know what Universal's saying there. And blast water cannons at flame-like targets to practice putting out fires, a crucial skill to master when living with dragons. So I'm kind of surprised that we haven't seen this kind of water ride shooting gallery before in a domestic Disney or a Universal park, because they're all over Europe. And you'd think with Florida's weather, it would be popular.
Wow, this is next generation Popeye and Bluto's Bildrat.
Bildrat, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
this is my early pick for surprise hit of Epic Universe, by the way, Fire Drill. I'm going on the record with that.
I got to say, based only on the concept art, you're not wrong. That looks amazing. Wow.
Also, Universal released bird's eye view concept art of the entire land. And Jim, looking at this in the show notes, is it me or is this giving Beastly Kingdom vibes?
Yeah.
You know what? Imitation is the sincerest form of flattery.
Well, again, remember the central attraction of that was Dragon's Tower, but yeah, I would.
There's a tower. There are dragons. Okay, sure, whatever.
There we go. Wow.
There's concept art released for Village Plaza as well, which has. I'm noting here, Jim, that Universal is putting water features both in rides and in the lands, and I think this is something that we've all learned from Batuu. That a land needs water. I don't care how you fit it in. I don't care how it goes in the story. Water is good in lands.
And remember, from the previous Epic universe, the very center of the park that it was going to, it was green and lush and put the park back in theme park. This is just sort of continuing that conceit.
Yeah, and plenty of shade too. The other attraction that I think Universal is importing from Europe is called Dragon Racers Rally. The description here is that new Vikings can practice aerobatic maneuvers and high-speed barrel rolls onto two Viking-made dragon riding trainers that reach heights of up to 67 feet in the air. So what this is a giant arm with seats on one end and the arm swings around. These kinds of rides are staples of European theme parks. I'm surprised we haven't seen them more in the United States, but this is one of those things that's relatively straightforward. It's almost off the shelf. You can put it in relatively inexpensively, put your money somewhere else, but still have some additional capacity for the park.
Okay, and just a quick phrase to take to mind before getting on the trainer. Breakfast afterwards?
Yeah, breakfast. Yeah, ride yeah. First, breakfast later. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
The other thing I thought that was interesting here was Viking Training Camp, which is a Viking agility course with teeter-totters, dragon climbers, and so much more. And looking at this, it's an elaborate Viking-themed play area. This reminds me of DCA's Grizzly Peak area in terms of its scope and its ambition.
You're not wrong, but on the other hand, far more colorful, far more playful. Yeah, no, this looks great.
Multiple levels, of playground equipment, tons of shade, lots of places to sit. Yeah, so this looks like a very, very elaborate kids' play area. And we've done the Grizzly Peak thing at DCA.
Yeah.
I thought it was a hoot. We went down the slides and everything and ran around and it was great.
It's charming, but what's interesting is to watch how Disney every so often will look for ways to shoehorn an IP into it, whether it was Brother Bear or,
yeah,
you know, that sort of thing. So,
and here the IP is built in.
There we go.
There's also a character greeting where you get to meet Hiccup and Toothless. And I think that rounds out the attractions. In terms of food, the big draw is going to be Mead Hall, which Universal says is, quote, the beating heart of Burke in the village's main gathering hall. Mead Hall is where guests can feast like a Viking and enjoy a savory menu featuring a variety of meats, fish, sandwiches, and more, along with a collection of meads and ciders. Jim, I am just going to point out here that wassail is an alcoholic punch typically served around holidays, and that wassailing as a verb means to drink while going door to door around your village. So if you're a theme park and you're looking for your next big holiday event, maybe dust off that copy of Beowulf and get to reading about meat halls.
Grendel grabbed your arm and pulled. Grendel grabbed your arm and pulled it right off of its socket.
It actually looks good. It looks very, very themed. I'm excited for it. Spitfire, F-Y-R-E Grill, overlooks the Fire Drill Water attraction. It's a quick service dining location with hearty meals flame seared by a helpful but unseen dragon fry cook. You want everyone to feel like they're contributing, and having a dragon as a fry cook is fine. Hooligans Grog and Gruel. Guests can grab quick bites at this festive racing-themed food stand located near the Viking camp. And then, of course, we've got some merch available, including Viking Traders, How to Treat Your Dragon, Hiccup's Workshop, and Toothless's Treasures. So pretty good rundown of the land. It looks very solid, something for everyone in there. And I like the fact that Universal is not making these lands, you know, one attraction, one restaurant, and a shop, and we're done. Right, we've got several attractions here.
Now remember, you know, once upon a time, the whole conceit was you'd be able to, you know, take these individual lands and sort of block them off from the park to stage corporate events. I mean, that was the whole conceit of this park is close to the convention center. So something like this where you have multiple eateries and multiple shops and, you know, that feeds into that idea. My understanding that isn't quite the priority anymore for this project, but you're not wrong. I mean, I love the variety. I love the level of detail. Going to be interesting to see if Mead winds up being, you know, the next Butterbeer, but I guess we'll find out next year.
It's a shot. Yeah. So five attractions, if you're counting the character greeting and the play area. So that's a good number. Plus you've got a couple of restaurants. Yeah. I mean, this is a solid addition. This is a substantial land in any theme park. So good there. Also, last week, Disney released more details on Tiana's Bayou Adventure, and the premise is that Tiana's throwing a party and needs a band, so you're helping Tiana search the bayou for animal musicians. Also, Imagineers have started test rides. Have you seen this?
Yeah. One or two have actually gotten on social media. That's me in the log. So, yeah.
So I'm hearing mid-June for a media event, which means previews probably start early June. All of this can change. I think the important thing to note is that the information that we're getting now has narrowed down the opening window from summer 2024 to the first half of June, assuming everything goes well with testing, right? So we're getting closer and closer to having specific dates. All right, Jim, and I'm going to point this out. You know how I feel about change, Jim. It scares me. I'm excited about Tiana's because it's a new theme for a ride system I love, and it's going to get more people into the parks, which is good for everyone. Just as long as we're done for now with changing classic Frontierland attractions. We're done for now, right, Jim?
Len.
We're done, Jim, right?
Okay. Sit here on my
knee. All right, fine,
Hill explain to you how it goes down, okay?
On to another topic then, Jim.
On to another topic, all right.
Large sections of Morocco at Epcot are back behind construction walls, and this I've got a photo in the show notes from our friends over at WDW Magic. So, Jim, this has been sort of like on and off for a few months. And we've seen Imagineers walking around with blueprints. We've seen them pointing at walls and stuff. I don't think there's anything substantial going in here like a ride. But this feels to me like there's a lot of deferred maintenance in this particular pavilion and they need to get it done. So they're doing it now.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. There is a plan, you know, but the problem is that we're still in the tail end of Communicore Plaza, finally getting buttoned up and that sort of thing. So there's a plan, you know, but when the plan gets executed, but long story short, Len's not wrong. This isn't necessarily anything sexy that's going on here, folks. This is just maintenance that really needed to be done years ago now. And, you know, just stuff that sort of like keep this as a placeholder and watch this space in the future.
I mean, speaking of placeholders, you'll note that in the back of that pavilion, there's an unused shop that has been closed, the rug shop that's been closed since the pandemic, and Restaurant Marrakesh never came back. So there's options to do things there. Now it's just a matter of, do we have the people, the money, and the time to throw at it?
And the other thing that I've been hearing is this is classic Disney. You know, the notion of, you know, they're walking along their corporate trap line to the effect of, hey, we have this space at Epcot. You know, anybody want to help sponsor something?
Preferably with some connection to Northern Africa, right? Have you ever been to Morocco? Do you have a Fez? Do you like Pez? That's close enough, right?
And they're in Connecticut, so go.
All right, last bit of park news. Disney Dreams That Soar, the drone show, Jim, that we mentioned at the end of last week's show, has a bit more detail. So it's at Disney Springs. It's going to run May 24th to September 2nd, so basically summer. And Jim, this comes on the heels of Disneyland Paris's 500 drone show, the Disney Electrical Sky Parade, which I believe is the Main Street Electrical Parade, right? But in the sky.
Seriously, if you have not seen it to date, run, do not walk over to YouTube. There's a couple of really well done videos of it that show how it's sort of the classic projection mapping show on the castle with fountains. But at the same time, you have these drones in the air over the castle recreating classic elements from the Main Street Electrical Parade. And it's wonderful. If this is something on that size and that scale. Now, mind you, of course, Disney Springs doesn't have a castle.
And it's going to happen over the water where there are no
It's going to happen over the water, but I'll take it. I'll take it.
So, Jim, let me ask you this question, right? We've said before that Europe's legal system seems to take the view that experience at theme park carries with it some inherent risk, right? So, like, there's a French lawyer who takes a drag on his cigarette before saying, if the drone crashes, it crashes, eh? It is alive one moment and then poof. C'est la vie, n'est-ce pas? Right? I mean, that's basically every legal briefing that in Disneyland Paris, right? But do you think that this is a test flight, for in-park drone shows?
The problem here, Len, is that, in fact, you're the one who's actually shared the patents that Disney has filed for previous versions of the show. I mean, I remember the one, for example, the drone that was shown with the Jack Skellington puppet dangling underneath it. And the notion was that, you know, Jack Skellington would appear out over the water, you know, on World Showcase Lagoon. And I've had my heart broken before, Len. I mean, that's, again, just this whole notion of, okay, we're finally getting in. It's a 500, drone show, and it's at Disney Springs. I'll take it. If it never goes anywhere else on Florida, though, worth noting, we were just talking about Universal, and a couple of nights ago, a couple of weeks ago now, I want to say it's Alicia Stella who posted these videos, but they were doing drone tests over Universal Florida Lagoon. So there's going to be dueling drone shows in Florida this summer.
You know, Alicia posted that video, and if there wasn't video, I would be like, were you sitting on your porch drinking moonshine? Like, what was Jimmy Carter's story when he saw the UFO? Was it like, Billy had brought me some beer, and we had a cooler open, and on the drive back, I saw you. Like, that's what I was thinking. Like, oh, you saw a drone show. Yeah, really? Yeah.
Actually, the more famous story is, remember, Carter came back and said he was attacked by a rabbit while he was in a canoe, and it was decades after he had left the White House that somebody in the press corps actually produced an image of Carter in the canoe with this
paddle, holding the paddle.
And more to the point, a rabbit that was the size of a coyote. But you're not wrong. The notion that somebody had a weather cam on their porch and just randomly caught the drone test out over Universal.
All right, last little bit of news. Joe Rohde confirmed last week that he's working again with Imagineering. You and I think, had been told that there was interest on both sides. Is it reasonable to assume that because it's, quote, his park, Joe's involved in the upcoming Animal Kingdom projects? Moving on. All right, we're going to take a quick commercial break.
I just want to point out that on previous shows you've mentioned, Indiana Jones, the Raiders is set in South America, Encanto is set in South America, and if you're going to do South American Animal Kingdom, maybe there'll be a few animals. Hey, what an idea,
The reason why I phrased it like this is because I know what you know, and I didn't want to say it.
There we go. All right. So
I wrote the show notes, so I put it back on you. All right. We're going to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, Jim tells us how Walt Disney World's Treasure Island became Discovery Island, assuming we don't stab each other in the back.
There we go.
We'll be right back to explore this wilderness.
Walt Disney once said that for every laugh, there should be a tear, which is why I think, anyway, he would have loved Drawn to Life, that hugely entertaining, surprising, and emotional spectacle that's now being presented live on stage at Disney Springs in Lake Buena Vista, Florida. Presented by Cirque du Soleil and Disney, this is a show that I can guarantee you will captivate audiences of all ages. I saw this show during a recent trip to Walt Disney World, and let me tell you, I'm ready to go see it again right now. Drawn to Life is filled with breathtaking acrobatics, stunning visuals, and heartwarming storytelling. The creative geniuses behind Cirque du Soleil and Walt Disney Animation Studios have come together to create this show where imagination literally knows no bounds. Filled with dazzling performances, not to mention beloved Disney characters coming to life in ways you've only just dreamed about, Drawn to Life is a must-see, family-friendly spectacle that will leave you, well, in awe. So don't miss out on your chance to be part of the magic. Plan your visit to Disney Springs today and reserve your seats for Drawn to Life by Cirque du Soleil and Disney, live on stage. Set your imagination in motion.
And we're back. All right, Jim, I am super excited about this because one of the things that I enjoy in learning about Disney history is the concept art. And some of the concept art that we've seen for Walt Disney World's Treasure Island is so amazing that it's hard to believe we didn't get it.
Well, I want to say that what prompted us to sort of circle back to the Treasure Island story is that Retro WDW, the folks who do such a great job of taking people's home movies and that sort of thing and restoring them, would give us the opportunity to look at the park, look at the resort very early on. Just recently, they got a hold of a film that was made available to networks, to the news groups, and that sort of thing. We're talking late 69, early 70, Len. So the project is very, it's kind of ironic. It's under construction, but the finer points are still kind of in flux. And at one point in this film, there is a shot of the massive model of the Walt Disney World property, and they zero in on Treasure Island. And you look at it and it's like, that's like the size of Big Thunder. This orange rock work, what are they going to do out there? And again, that was where the Benbow Inn was supposed to be built. And that was where Ben Gunn's cave, you know, was going to be located, and all of this stuff. But none of that ultimately happened. And there's a reason for that, which we're about to get into. So anyway, before we talk Treasure Island, Discovery Island, whatever, we have to acknowledge how we got here. It's 1963. It's Walt flying over Bay Lake, looks down at Raz Lake Island, which is what Discovery Island, Treasure Island was called. And, you know, he's aboard Mickey Mouse One, you know, the Gulfstream the company owned, and looks down and goes, that's it. And with those two words, Walt Disney World goes from we should build another Disneyland, maybe on the East Coast, to a hard reality.
We're going to build it here.
That's it, exactly. Now, mind you, we know the exact date that this happened, and that was November 22nd, 1963, because as the plane pivots and begins its trip back to Burbank, they stop for fuel in New Orleans, and it's there out on the tarmac that Walt and his team learn that JFK has just been assassinated in Dallas.
Yeah, so we know the date. Okay.
We know the date. So next few months, obviously sad time for the nation, but a busy time at Disney, because just 6 months till the four shows for the World's Fair have to be up and running in Flushing Meadow. And mind you, the folks in 1401 Flower Street, you know, they're focused on the World's Fair, but they're also, you know, aware of Project Florida, you know, which, by the way, won't be announced officially for another 2 years, November 16th, 1965. And thinking in house is, look, we have to do something special with Raz Island. I mean, this is the reason Walt bought all of this swampland in Central Florida, that island. And the thing is, Walt Land was kind of squirrely when it came to islands. I mean, there's this famous story of it's late summer, early fall of 54, and they're digging the Rivers of America in Anaheim, which means that while this is going on, because they're literally digging around what will become Tom Sawyer's Island. It's like, you know, we kind of need to know what the shape of the island is. And Walt literally takes the site plan home with him that weekend and comes in Monday, and he's hand-drawn in where all of the coves and the inlets are supposed to go. And it's like, you know, hand this to the guy who's with the backhoe.
Make it this.
So that's the thing. They know how he's going to be about this island. So there's like, all right, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And this gets especially complicated because, of course, we lose Walt in December of 66. And the broad strokes of Project Florida had been mapped out, you know, where the Vacation Kingdom was going to go, which, by the way, surprise, surprise, land right at the edge of Bay Lake.
Go figure.
Yeah, there we go. And they know where the 6-mile-long north South Road is going to go and the entrance complex, but Raz Island is still kind of vague. So at this point, it's named Blackbeard's Island, which kind of makes sense. February of 68, Walt Disney Production releases Blackbeard's Ghost to theaters, a supernatural comedy starring 2-time Academy Award winner Sir Peter Ustinov. He's playing the title character. Does reasonably well at the box office, but the real reason that the Imagineers are like, let's make it Blackbeard's Island, because November of 66, this is after the doctors at St. Joe's, the hospital across the street from the studio, had removed most of Walt's cancer-ridden left lung. He returned to the Disney lot for one day, and one of the places he visited that day was the soundstage where Blackbeard's Ghost was being shot, and he reportedly had this, you know, a fun time chatting with Ustinov and his co-stars, Dean Jones and Suzanne Plachette. You know, everyone was being fun and laughing it up with him. And this pall fell over the set because he looked terrible. I mean, he was wearing a mustard yellow cardigan. And people said, you know, his skin color was almost identical to the thing he was wearing. And it just, Suzanne Plachette tells the story of as soon as he walked out the door, she ran to her dressing room and just burst into tears. In fact, I think it was Jones that turned to Ustinov and is like, he's a dead man. Oh my God. So anyway, the folks who are building Walt Disney World are like, let's do that. He had a happy time while he was visiting the Blackbeard set, and people in the company will understand that this is Blackbeard's Island. But at the same time, they're going into the Walt Disney World project being very cagey about pirates, and that's all because of the Gasparilla Pirate Festival.
Oh, in Tampa.
There we go. And this had been a really big thing for a long time. I mean, the very first, according to the Tampa Tribune, very first one of these pirate festivals is held in 1904. They were done to honor the memory of Jose Gaspar, a pirate who worked the waters of Western Florida, and evidently, Len, he was the Jimmy Buffett of his day. Much more interesting.
More advocate of margaritas and cheeseburgers.
There we go. The raping and pillaging, not as much a priority, you know. But what's tough about this is that because that's a thing, and this is a Disney company that is coming into Florida that wants to be seen as a good neighbor. And so the whole notion is Tampa is only 84 miles away from Orlando. And if we bring pirates, you know, which, by the way, again, had only opened at Disneyland in March of 67.
A couple years earlier. Yeah.
And it was a huge hit. But the whole notion is like, you know, we don't want to be seen horning in on Tampa's action. We want those people happy. We want them to drive over to Orlando to visit the Magic Kingdom. So if we're going to do stuff with pirates, it's got to be Disney pirates. It's got to be, you know, it's like Captain Hook and Peter Pan. And more to the point, it's like, look, if we're going to do this, why don't we do something with the studio's first ever live-action movie, which was Treasure Island, released to theaters in 1950. And by the way, folks, I know there are Disney films that had live-action elements before 1950. You know, Fantasia in 1940, Reluctant Dragon in 1941, Saludos Amigos in 42, then, of course, Song of the South in 46, and So Dear to My Heart in 48, but all of those films also featured animation or were primarily animated, whereas Disney's live-action version of Treasure Island, which was, of course, based on the Robert Louis Stevenson book from 1883, was animation-free. It was entirely shot in live-action. And for more to the point, entirely shot over in England because after the war, England, there had been Disney films in release over there, and they had made a ton of money. And the thing is that given how crippled the English economy was after this point, Parliament met and you know, the House of Commons, and they set this amazing rule to the effect of, why, yes, you know, we have your money here in England. And if you come here and spend it, you can spend it, but we're not sending it back to you.
I think every country in Europe had, or most countries in Europe had similar restrictions after the war that to preserve hard currency.
Oh, yeah.
You needed to keep it in the country.
That's it, exactly.
But that also gives Disney plausible cover for bringing in pirates. Like, oh, well, Tampa, you've got Caribbean pirates, but we've got European pirates. And everyone knows those are completely different sets of pirates.
Right? They're completely different species. Oh, my God.
What? Barely the same.
Okay. Also worth noting here, Treasure Island is an enormous success when it's released. It gets re-released a couple times over the next 20 years. But what's fascinating, 1975, Disney goes to re-release it again. Just as a courtesy, they send it to the MPAA, the Motion Pictures Association, the folks who determine what rating a film should have. And they come back and say, you know, there's a scene in this where Jim Hawkins shoots a pirate directly in the face. You know, we're going to have to give you a PG.
That might have been okay in the 50s.
Well, no, that's it exactly. You know, and what's so funny is that at this point, in this window of time, Disney has announced to the world that they will only release family-friendly entertainment.
Right, so G. Yeah, they're committed to G films, yeah.
Yeah, so what ends up happening, Len, is they cut out 9 minutes of footage out of anything where, you know, somebody raises a pistol or that sort of thing. So it's, you know, Treasure Island is suddenly far shorter, and it's like, it wasn't, you know, I see a lot of swashing, but not much buckling.
And so the film had been out for 20-some years.
Yep.
And it was fine. Okay. All right. I mean, times change. Okay. Fair.
No, they do.
I'd be a little upset about that if I was Disney, but okay.
No, I get that as well. All right. Speaking of the 70s, once the Vacation Kingdom portion of the Magic Kingdom opens October of 71, attention now turns to Rez Island, turning into Treasure Island. So 50,000 cubic yards of dirt is hauled out to the island, an additional 500,000 pounds of rocks. They expand the island out from 7 acres to 11 acres, and in the 1972 edition of the Disney Annual Report, published in November 30th that year, here's what they say. Work has been progressing since last summer on the first phase of Treasure Island. Walkways, small lakes, and waterfalls will be available for explorers and picnickers starting in 1973. Sometime after that, the rest of this picturesque spot in Bay Lake will then become home to recreations to memorable locations from Walt Disney Pictures' 1950 release. Among these will be the Benbow Inn, the Wreck of the Hispaniola, and Ben Gunn's Cave. And the annual report was off by about a year. Treasure Island didn't actually open till April of 74. And as for those recreations of memorable places and things from Disney's 1950s Treasure Island, only the Wreck of the Hispaniola was installed. Now, mind you, the walkways were put in and... You walk around the island as, oh, I'm passing Doubloon Lagoon or I'm on Black Dog Bridge. But this is an especially funny story about, they put the Wreck of the Hespers in and they're doing a little set decorating and they just said, oh, you know what would be cool? Let's put like the skeleton of a pirate out on the beach. Like, he made it out of the Wreck of the Hispaniola, but then died on the beach. So they put the skeleton on the beach and they come back the next morning. And the bones of this all plastic skeleton have been scattered across the beach. And there on the beach, glowering at the Imagineers, is this flock of turkey vultures who are like, whose idea of a sick joke was this?
You bastards.
Okay, we've talked previously about how, Walt Disney World opens October 71, and how people would tour the park and then go to City Hall and say, this is great, but where's Pirates of the Caribbean? You have all these recreations of other rides from Disneyland. Why didn't that make the trip to Florida? And the folks at City Hall...
I think this is interesting because this should have been Disney's first hint that the demographic of visitors coming to Florida would be vastly different than the visitors coming to Disneyland in California, because the people who are coming from all over the country don't know about the Gasparilla Festival in Tampa, and they don't care about that. They're like, that's great. They can have their thing, but we want pirates here. So, give Disney credit for trying to do the right thing. But at the end of the day, they have to make the park popular.
No, that's exactly. I mean, for like 6 months, they put up the good fight. They do exactly what you just said. They explain about Gasparilla. They explain about, we're doing different stuff in Florida.
Good neighbors. Yeah.
And eventually it is just what you say. Just sort of like, all right, we have to do this. But at the same time, you have to understand the financial realities. The cost of constructing Walt Disney World had famously gone over budget. Originally budgeted for just $100 million, wound up costing, they will admit to, $400 million. And let's not forget about the Arboreal embargo in October of 73, just 2 years after Project Florida opens. So obviously some hard decisions have to be made.
Jim, real quick. So October of 73 is the Arab oil embargo. When did airline deregulation didn't happen until... The 80s?
Ooh.
So we're still at a point where most people are driving, right?
No, absolutely.
Okay. That makes more sense. Okay. Yeah. So I'm trying to figure out how much of the local tourism market was impacted by that, but that's quite a bit. Because if you're in Florida, you're driving and gas is now suddenly way more expensive. Okay. Got it. Okay.
Yeah. And remember odd, even rationing, depending on the number on your license plate, that sort of thing. So, all right, back to hard decision. The folks out in California are staring down the barrel. There is just not enough money to do two pirate-themed projects of size. And if the Magic Kingdom was going to get a version of Disneyland's Pirates of the Caribbean rushed into that park, that means that there is going to be a reduction of scope over on Treasure Island. And so no Benbow Inn, no Ben Gunn's Cave. And as a direct result, again, people would go over it. It's like, I'm on Treasure Island. Where are the pirates? It never caught fire, which is why starting in 76, but formally done in 77, Treasure Island is renamed Discovery Island. It's now a place where you wander around and look at animals on exhibit. And kind of a fun little bend on this story is that as part of the relaunch, Disney decided to tie a promotional campaign for Discovery Island to the release of The Rescuers, which came out in June of 77. And you may recall sort of the MacGuffin of that movie was the Devil's Eye, the giant diamond that Madame Medusa, that's why she kidnapped Penny to send her down into the hole to get this diamond. And so what they did to tie the Discovery Island to the rescuers is they hid a $25,000
diamond. A $25,000
diamond
in 1977 money?
In 1977 money.
That's like the Hope Diamond, Jim. What? That's something Elizabeth Taylor would wear. What?
Well, there we go.
What does a $25,000 diamond look like in 1977?
The interesting thing is I found this story while doing research for this week's feature over at Walt Dated World, a wonderful site, and they literally have the print ad for the contest there on the site as part of their Discovery Island, Treasure Island feature. So, you know, invite you to go over and take a look at that. But yeah, I'm just doing research on this myself now. It's like, wow, what a cool story.
Okay, so just some quick Googling here. So a $25,000 diamond in 1977 is roughly $135,000 diamond today, which would get you a 5-carat round brilliant stone in VVS1 D quality. So yeah, a nice rock.
There we go. There
okay.
We got to find out carats. Who found this and what they did with it. But anyway,
I think when you get past like 4 carats, you have to have someone carry your hand around. Does it come with like a little support thing on it?
There you go. Right. The type of thing you put on the end of a cane. So, you know, all right.
Exactly.
Anyway, back to Discovery Island. Look, you know, closed in April of 99, a year after Animal Kingdom opened. And there has been a lot of stuff proposed for, you know, this. I mean, we had the Lost theme experience. We had the Myst.
I remember this, yeah.
Myst experience.
Yeah.
And for a time, there was even talk of building exclusive honeymoon cottages out on the island. You would be transported there in a cigarette boat. But Disney has yet to turn the key on any of these ideas. And you got to imagine Walt wouldn't be happy to hear this, but more to the point, he's been gone for 58 years now, and Disney's a different company now.
You bring up a great point here that, like, when it comes to choosing projects to do, right, the revenue model for putting Pirates of the Caribbean in a theme park is really easy to understand, right? We put the ride in, people are clamoring for it, they will pay money to get into the park. We'll make money off of food and, you know, merch and stuff like that. The revenue model for the island is vastly more difficult to understand. Number one, to your point, you're talking about a couple hundred people a day, tops, right? It's basically the River Country problem all over again. So limit to its capacity. It's going to be a hassle to get there, right? It just doesn't make sense as anything other than a very boutique experience for high rollers. And even then, is that the market that Disney wants to go after for that?
By the way, slightly off topic, but I have got myself a copy of Ken Bruce's wonderful Walt Disney's Enchanted Tiki Room, Before the Bird Sang Words. And there's an amazing foreword written by Pixar veteran director Brad Bird. But they, Brad Bird.
Mm,
yeah.
Okay.
Well, there we go.
He
no,
was,
that's
he
it
was
exactly.
He was fated from birth to write that forward. Yeah.
Well, no, in fact, that's how he ends his forward. You know, but I believe the reason that Ken asked me to write this forward was solely because of my last name. But he has a line in here, you know, that you know, again, Walt Disney ran this company differently. And it's just basically that, you know, I don't make movies to make money. I make movies so I have money to do things. And that was the thing. He wanted here we go. I don't make movies to make money. I make money to make movies. And it just kind of kills me that the very reason that, you know, he picked this spot in Florida, that 25 years, Len, that thing has been sitting in.
Yeah, it can be something, but I don't think that's in anyone's, you know, even in their 20-year plans at this point. It's a fun exercise to give to new people coming in. What would you do here and see what happens?
And the irony is, if you talk to anybody who works at security at the Walt Disney World Resort, they will tell you about how much money or how much time they have to spend keeping urban explorers off the island, all of whom want the footage of, you know, swimming over or wandering through the now decrepit remains of Treasure Island, Discovery Island, whatever you want to call it.
Jim, one of the reasons why I don't take the ferry from the TTC to the Magic Kingdom is because I am sorely tempted to jump overboard at night and make a swim for it. And if not for my completely irrational fear of alligators, I would have done it already. Like, I'm not afraid of the legal consequences. I'm afraid of getting eaten by some prehistoric reptile. And that's what's keeping me off of that island. Honest to God.
Having met a few Disney lawyers in my time, the Venn diagram between prehistoric
reptiles and lawyers.
And Disney alligator. Yeah, Disney lawyers. Very small line. Very narrow.
I believe the term you're looking for there is colleagues. But anyway.
Ah, there we go. Okay.
All right, folks. That's going to do it for the show today. You can help support our show by subscribing over at patreon.com/JimHillMedia, where we're posting exclusive shows every week. Check it out at patreon.com/JimHillMedia. You can find more of Jim at jimhillmedia.com and more of me, Len, at touringplans.com. We're produced spectacularly by Eric Hersey, who'll be explaining how to tell your common mirrors from your thick-billed mirrors and your tufted puffins from your horned puffins at the 2024 Seward Seabird Festival, May 31st through June 2nd, at the Alaska Sea Life Center on Railway Avenue in beautiful downtown Seward, Alaska. While Eric's doing that, please go into iTunes and rate our show and tell us what you'd like to hear next. For Jim, this is Len. We'll see you on the next show. The Galactic Star Cruiser isn't dead.